You're listening to Agentic Economy, the research podcast on autonomous agent commerce by René Deschamps-Otamendi from agenticeconomy.dev. The engineering, the economics, and the math behind an economy built for machines.
Imagine this. You are fast asleep in your bed. It's 3.0 a.m.
Okay.
And while you are dreaming, your phone silently wakes up. It searches the internet, finds a sudden price drop on a weekend flight to Rome, and just books it for you.
Oh, wow.
Right. But it doesn't stop there. It navigates this complex refund for a defective smart TV you complained about yesterday, fighting with the merchant's customer service bot.
A literal bot-to-bot fight.
Exactly. And just to top it off, it orders a new batch of supplies for your small business, signing a legally binding contract with a supplier in Germany. All of this happens, the money actually leaves your accounts, the legal commitments are locked in, and you haven't even opened your eyes yet.
It really sounds like the opening scene of a science fiction movie, doesn't it? I mean, the completely autonomous digital assistant seamlessly managing your life while you rest.
It really does. But the wild thing is, this isn't sci-fi. It is happening right now. Like, the technology is here, the market is live, and the rules of this entirely new game are being written, literally, as we speak.
Yeah, the rules are barely keeping up.
So let's unpack this. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are taking on a massive mission. We have a huge stack of sources in front of us, but the absolute crown jewel is this highly detailed 40-plus page EU policymaker's guide from right now, May 2026.
And the title is Agentic Commerce in the EU.
Yep, right. That's the one.
You know, it is a sobering document to read through, and frankly, it's a necessary one. I mean, we are looking at a landscape where AI systems are no longer just chatting with us or summarizing articles or writing our emails.
Right. The stakes are way higher now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They're actually spending our money.
Uh-huh.
And they're signing contracts on our behalf.
And the urgency here is very real. I mean, today's date is May 13th, 2026. The central applicability phase of the EU AI Act opens in just a few months on August 2, 2026.
Right around the corner.
So we are standing on the precipice of this massive regulatory shift. And going through the source document, it's almost dizzying. It covers everything from fundamental consumer rights to carbon border taxes. And it's trying to tie all of these massive threads together before that August deadline.
The sheer breadth is really what stands out. But what is truly fascinating here, at least to me, is that the real story isn't actually the AI technology itself.
Wait, really? It's an AI guide, though.
Well, yes, but the neural networks, the large language models, the sophisticated prompt engineering, those are just the engines. The true focus of this guide is the invisible legal plumbing required to make this technology safe and functional in society.
Oh, I see. The plumbing.
Right. It's an exploration of how European law is grappling with systems that initiate transactions with real, irrevocable commercial or legal effect.
The plumbing. I like that. Because before we can even begin to understand the rules of the road, we really have to understand the scale of the traffic that is already driving on it.
We definitely need to define our terms here.
Yeah, and the scale mentioned in the guide is just staggering. Look at this statistic from the source. Alipay reported over 120 million agent-initiated transactions in a single week.
And that was back in February 2026.
Right. Millions of transactions where a human wasn't pushing the final button. Just let that sink in.
And the guide makes a point to emphasize that Western frameworks are not far behind that Asian volume at all.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, systems like the Stripe and OpenAI Agentic Commerce Protocol or the Google MasterCard PayPal AP2 framework, they're moving from specification to live production within 12 months of that reported volume.
Wow. So it's happening fast.
The operational footprint is observable today. We are not talking about some hypothetical 2030 projection here. We are talking about the reality of Q3 2026.
So these invisible shoppers are already here, right? They're roaming the digital aisles. But when policymakers try to sit down and regulate this, they run into a massive vocabulary problem.
Oh, a massive one.
I mean, how do you regulate something if you can't even agree on what to call it?
That is a crippling hurdle for any legislator. Mm. I mean, the author of the guide actually analyzed the public corpus of 57 different definitions.
57? That's insane.
Right. 57 definitions of terms like agentic economy and agentic commerce. And these definitions were pulled from regulators, AI providers, and academics across the US, the EU, the UK, China, and the OECD.
So everyone has a different idea of what this even is.
Exactly. And when you have 57 different ways of defining a problem, you are virtually guaranteed to get 57 different conflicting policy solutions.
Let's break that down for you. if the OECD defines this phenomenon purely by how it displaces human labor, and the EU defines it by software architecture, a multinational tech company literally cannot build a product that complies with both.
They'd be paralyzed.
Right. So how does this guide cut through all that noise?
Well, it forces a critical distinction right up front. The document strictly separates the agentic economy from agentic commerce.
Okay, economy versus commerce.
Yes. The agentic economy is treated as the broad, almost philosophical macro phenomena. It encompasses the diffusion of AI across knowledge work, the downstream impacts on labor markets, macroeconomics, wages, and civic life.
The big picture stuff.
Exactly. Those are vital debates, but they are long-run, generational issues that will literally take years to settle.
And a policymaker staring down an August 2026 deadline absolutely does not have years.
That is the crux of the issue right there. That is why the guide narrows the focus surgically to agentic commerce.
And how do they define that exactly?
The definition provided is strict, it's measurable, and it's actionable. It is an AI system acting under a person or company's mandate that completes a transaction with commercial or legal effect.
Okay, I really appreciate that clarity. It kind of cuts through all that existential dread about AI taking our jobs or becoming sentient and just focuses on the immediate, tangible reality the AI is spending my money.
Exactly. It's grounded.
But even within that narrow definition of commerce, the guide points out that people look at this through different lenses, right? There are six framings currently circulating in the policy world.
Yes, the six framings. They are the autonomy lens, the protocol lens, the workflow lens, the market lens, the labor lens, and finally, the chain lens.
Okay, let's pause on that first one, because to me, it seems like the most obvious. The autonomy lens.
It is the most common initial approach, yeah.
Because if I'm a regulator, my first instinct is to say, let's classify these things by how smart they are or how much they can do without asking me.
Right, trying to measure the intelligence.
Yeah. I'm thinking of this like regulating a self-driving car. You know, we have level 1 to level 5 autonomy for vehicles. Why can't we just do that for AI agents? Just regulate the engine.
Let's actually follow that logic for a second. If you adopt the autonomy lens, which emphasizes the degree to which a system decides things without human approval, you end up with these neat little regulatory ladders.
Like level 1 AI does this, level 5 AI does that.
Precisely. But that framework completely collapses in production.
Why does it collapse, though? It sounds so logical.
Because autonomy in software is often configurable per action in real time. A self-driving car's engine doesn't suddenly become a bicycle engine mid-trip.
Oh, that's a great point.
Right. But an AI agent might have high autonomy to browse flights, but zero autonomy to select the payment method, and maybe medium autonomy to negotiate a refund.
So it's shifting gears constantly.
Exactly. If your regulation targets the autonomy level, you are basically targeting a moving shadow. The guide explicitly warns against this. If you pick a definition based on the wrong framing, you end up writing rules that protect a specific technological architecture rather than actually protecting the public interest.
Okay, so if regulating the engine is a trap, what is the alternative here? How does this guide frame the problem instead?
It adopts the chain lens.
That chain lens. Okay, explain how that shifts the perspective.
Well, the chain lens entirely abandons the focus on the software's internal intelligence. Instead, it emphasizes the entire sequence of the transaction from beginning to end.
So it's looking at the whole journey.
Yes. It establishes a legal test that must be run on every single agent transaction. And this chain has six distinct links.
Okay, what are the links?
Principal to software agent to venue to rail to finality to record.
Okay, let me write that down. Principal, agent, venue, rail, finality, record. Okay, let's make that concrete for you.
Sure.
So the principal is me, right, giving the instruction. The agent is the AI. The venue is where the shopping happens, like an airline's website or API.
Okay.
The rail is how the money moves. Finality is the moment the deal is locked in. And the record is the receipt I can use if I need to complain later.
You have the exact structure perfectly. The fundamental thesis of the report is that if a regulator looks at a transaction and cannot clearly name the entity occupying every single one of those six links, that missing link represents a massive, dangerous policy gap.
That makes abstract tech jargon feel incredibly tangible. It's not about how many parameters the neural network has. It's about whether we know who is holding the receipt.
Exactly.
And to really see how this six-link chain operates in the wild, the guide introduces us to two running cases, two stress tests for the existing European laws. Let's look at Alice and Bruno.
Yes. These two anchors are absolutely essential for understanding the divergent regulatory paths we are facing. Let's start with Alice. She represents the consumer. the B2C scenario.
Okay, wait a second.
Alice lives in Madrid. She runs an AI assistant on her phone. We can call it Orion.
Okay, let's play this out. Alice tells Orion, book me the cheapest refundable return flight to Rome the weekend of May 15th under 250 euros, departing after 16:00 on Friday.
A very standard, everyday kind of request. Now let's watch the six-link chain activate. In the span of about 15 seconds, Orion parses her natural language request and queries airline and aggregator endpoints machine-to-machine.
So it's talking to other computers instantly.
Right. And it applies Alice's known preferences without her even asking. Perhaps she has a standing preference in her settings for no red-eye flights and an aisle seat.
Nice. It filters everything and finds the top option. Let's say 180 euros, Iberia Airlines, Friday at 17.25, fully refundable. Alice's phone pings, she glances at the screen, and just taps confirm.
And the moment she taps, the invisible plumbing kicks into high gear. Orion transmits an authorization envelope to the airline's venue.
An authorization envelope?
Yes, which includes her scoped payment token and likely an identity credential. The airline verifies the envelope, reserves the seat, and returns a booking reference. The payment settles on Alice's chosen card rail, flagged specifically as an agent-initiated transaction with delegated authentication.
Wow.
And finally, Orion sends Alice the confirmation record.
Elapsed time, 15 seconds. One tap from a human finger. But looking at the guide, there is this incredible centerfold called the Single Transaction Atlas.
Oh, that diagram is amazing.
It's mind-blowing. It maps out exactly what regulatory events fired during that specific process. It is overwhelmingly complex. In just the 4 seconds of real time that elapsed during the actual booking execution, 24 distinct regulatory events fire across 6 phases.
The visualization is so crucial because it completely shatters the illusion of simplicity. It breaks that 4-second execution down into intent, deliberate, select, pay, settle, and confirm. And at every single microsecond, a different European directive or regulation is triggered.
Let's actually walk through that because it's wild.
Yeah.
At second zero, when she just gives the intent, the AI acts transparency rules and the GDPR's rules for lawful basis of processing data kick in immediately.
Instantaneously.
Right. Then a second later, as the agent deliberates and filters out flights, the AI acts risk categorization engages and GDPR's strict rules on automated decision making apply.
Then, as the agent actually selects the merchant, the Digital Services Act and the Digital Markets Act engage to ensure the platform isn't self-preferencing or hiding cheaper options from her.
And then we move into the payment phase. That triggers IDS 2.0 for identity verification and PSD 3 for payment authentication.
And it doesn't stop there. It continues into the settlement phase, triggering the transfer of funds regulation if any crypto assets happen to be involved. And finally, consumer rights directives govern the confirmation and the rules for how Alice can get her money back if something goes wrong.
24 massive legal events. And here's the crazy part to me. Almost all of those laws were drafted in different decades by different committees for completely different industries long before autonomous agents even existed.
That is the core problem.
And they all just violently collide in a 4-second window on Alice's phone.
That collision is the defining challenge for the EU right now. It puts into perspective why simply drafting a new AI law might not be the answer.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The real work is figuring out how the old laws interact with each other under this immense new technological pressure. Now, to see how different that pressure can be, we really have to contrast Alice with our second case, Bruno.
Right, Bruno. Bruno is the B2B case business to business. Let's say Bruno is the CFO of Cerámica de Porto, a 40-person tile manufacturing company in northern Portugal.
Okay.
His procurement agent, let's call it Orion B2B, runs integrated into their enterprise software.
Let's look at a typical Friday morning for Bruno. Orion B2B detects a supply issue and signals. Raw clay, short of target for the Hamburg shipment. Secure 14 tons under 15,000 euros. E-Origin preferred. CBAM compliance verified.
Okay, from a purely technological standpoint, this is the exact same thing Alice did. The AI looks for an item, checks the price, and prepares to buy it.
The surface mechanism is absolutely identical, but the legal surface area is an entirely different universe.
How so?
Well, Orion B2B queries 3 pre-approved suppliers via APIs, but it cannot just look at the price like Alice's agent did. It must pull corporate sustainability due diligence declarations to ensure the clay wasn't mined using forced labor.
Oh, wow.
Right. And it must pull Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism or CBAM declarations for each lot of clay to calculate import taxes.
So it's reading tax documents and human rights compliance forms in milliseconds.
Exactly. It shortlists 2 options. Bruno checks his phone, sees the 13,800 euro purchase from a German supplier, and signs off.
Okay. And
the contract then executes via a qualified electronic signature, returning a specific VAT ID. A SEPA credit transfer initiates the payment between the corporate bank account, and the resulting invoice must be archived in a highly structured e-invoicing format called VITA, mandated by the EU.
Okay, let's synthesize this. We have two principals, Alice and Bruno. They are using essentially the exact same underlying AI capabilities, right? Large language models, API integrations, automated reasoning.
Yes, the deck is the same.
But Alice lives entirely in the realm of consumer protection and retail payments, while Bruno is wading through the heavy machinery of corporate compliance, international customs, and B2B data sharing.
That divergence is precisely why the guys is deeply critical of sweeping horizontal pronouncements about, quote, regulating AI.
You can't just have one rule for both.
You cannot regulate Alice's flight booking and Bruno's raw clay procurement with the exact same broad strokes simply because they both utilize a neural network. The technology is a common denominator, but the risk profiles are entirely separate.
Which naturally brings us to the most massive piece of legislation hanging over all of this, the EU AI Act. This is the big new rule book dropping in August 2026. Given how different Alice and Bruno's situations are, how does the AI Act attempt to handle them both?
Well, the AI Act is a horizontal regulation, meaning it applies across all sectors. Its central architectural choice is risk tiering.
Risk tiering. What
policymakers must internalize this. The AI Act does not care about the complexity of the code. It does not care if you are using a simple script or a massive trillion-parameter foundation model. It cares strictly about what the system is used for, the outcome.
Okay, so it's judging the action, not the intellect of the AI.
Precisely. The Act outlines four risk tiers. Unacceptable, which is tier one and mostly banned outright. High risk, which is tier two. Limited risk, tier three. And minimal, tier four.
And where do these agents fall?
The vast majority of agentic commerce systems, the ones booking flights and paying standard invoices, will land in Tier 3, limited risk.
For a Tier 3 agent like Alice's flight booker, what are the actual legal obligations? Is it super heavy?
They are surprisingly light, actually. The primary obligation in Tier 3 is transparency. You are simply required to tell the natural person that they are interacting with an AI system rather than a human.
Just a label, basically. But wait. If Orion is just booking a flight, and that's Tier 3, what happens if Orion is asked to do something more serious? Let's say Alice isn't buying a flight. She's applying for the credit card to pay for the flight. Does that change things?
Radically. That scenario pushes the agent directly into Tier 2, the high-risk category. An agent moves into high risk if its function decides fundamental rights or access to essential services.
Like getting a loan.
Exactly. If the agent is scoring creditworthiness, screening job applicants, pricing life insurance, or mediating access to public housing, it hits Annex 3rd of the Act and becomes Tier 2.
And what's the regulatory burden for Tier 2?
It is immense. We are talking about mandatory risk management systems, strict data governance and bias testing, extensive technical logging, required human oversight interfaces, and continuous post-market monitoring.
The guide uses a really brilliant analogy here to explain this to non-lawyers. The waiter versus doctor analogy.
I love that analogy. It perfectly captures the spirit of the legislation. Consider a Tier 3 agent as a waiter taking your order in a restaurant. A Tier 2 agent is a doctor writing you a prescription.
Right, because both of them talk to you. Both of them take in information you give them, and both of them use professional judgment to give you something back. But the consequence of them getting it wrong is entirely different.
Exactly. If the waiter misunderstands you, you get the wrong soup. It is annoying, but you can send it back. It is a matter for standard commercial redress.
Just a basic customer service issue.
But if the doctor misinterprets your symptoms and prescribes the wrong medication, the harm is significant, systemic, and potentially irreversible.
Yeah, that's a huge difference.
The AI Act is essentially structured around this premise: provide transparency for the waiters, but mandate heavy preemptive compliance for the doctors.
That makes total sense. But practically speaking, who is on the hook for all this compliance? Because it's not just one startup in a garage building and using the AI anymore. The guide breaks down the ecosystem into three distinct legal roles: the provider, the deployer, and the service operator.
Untangling these roles is currently the primary challenge for corporate compliance teams. The AI Act formally distinguishes between the provider and the deployer. The provider is the entity that builds the model.
Okay, so the provider is your Anthropic, your Google, your OpenAI. They are training the massive neural networks and putting them on the EU market under their own name.
Exactly. They bear the heavy upstream burdens, conformity assessments, compiling technical documentation, and registering the model. Then you have the deployer. This is the entity using the system under its authority in the course of professional business.
Let's apply that to Bruno. Bruno's tile company, Ceramica do Porto, is the deployer. They aren't training AI models. They just bought an off-the-shelf procurement agent to run their weekly clay orders.
Yes. Bruno's company carries the deployer obligations. They must ensure they are using the system within the provider's instructions. They must assign human oversight, and they must retain the interaction logs for 6 months.
Okay, that covers provider and deployer. And then there is a third role, which the guide notes is a massive commercial reality, but strangely isn't a separate legal category in the AI Act, the service operator.
Right. The service operator sits at the customer interface. Imagine a large online travel platform. They license a foundation model from a provider, wrap it in their own branded user experience, and sell trips through it to users like Alice.
So to Alice, she is talking to the travel platform's specific bot.
Exactly.
I can see how this gets incredibly messy, because what if one company does all three? Like, what if a company builds the model, deploys it, and runs the service?
The guide explicitly notes that these roles stack. A common enterprise scenario involves a company taking an open source foundation model, fine-tuning it with their proprietary data, deploying it internally, and then surfacing it to their customers.
So they're wearing all three hats.
That single company is acting as provider, deployer, and service operator simultaneously. If you are conducting a legal assessment, the first necessary step is a role inventory, because under the AI Act, these obligations do not substitute for one another, they accumulate.
Okay, let's zoom back in on tier three, the waiters, because that's where the vast majority of our shopping agents are going to live. We established that the main rule for tier three is transparency. We have to tell people they are talking to a machine. This is governed by Article 50 of the AI Act. But reading the guide's breakdown of Article 50, I realized there is a massive gaping hole in the law.
You are referring to the agent-to-agent disclosure vacuum.
Yes.
It is arguably the most significant operational finding in the entire 40-page document.
Let's look at how Article 50 is supposed to work first. The guide says it has two limbs, two different duty holders.
Article 50 is structurally quite specific. The first limb requires that natural persons interacting with an AI system be informed of that fact. That duty falls on the deployer.
The deployer. Okay.
They must provide a direct interaction disclosure. Essentially, a flag stating you are interacting with an AI system.
That makes intuitive sense. If I open a chat window for customer service, I want to know if I'm arguing with a human or a bot.
Right. The second limb deals with the content itself. It requires that AI-generated synthetic content be marked in a machine-readable format. That duty falls upstream on the provider of the generative system.
So the deployer owes the disclosure of the interaction, and the provider owes the invisible marking of the output.
Precisely.
But here is where the logic hits a brick wall. Article 50 was clearly drafted with a very specific traditional interaction model in mind. It assumes there is a machine on one end of the keyboard and a natural human person on the other end reading the screen.
That assumption fundamentally misunderstands where production agentic commerce is heading right now. We are rapidly moving toward a paradigm where Alice's agent, Orion, bypasses human interfaces entirely and transacts directly with another agent, acting for the airline, machine to machine.
Wait, so if the bots are talking to each other in the dark, what happens to Article 50? Who gets the disclosure?
It fires into a complete legal vacuum.
A vacuum. Wow.
The deployer's statutory duty to disclose interaction is explicitly triggered by an interaction with a natural person. The provider's duty to mark content applies to content delivered to end users. Neither duty is drafted for an agent-to-agent exchange.
Let me make sure I grasp the danger of this. When Orion negotiates with the airline's bot to get a refund, there is no legal requirement for the airline's bot to disclose its non-human nature to Orion.
Not at all.
There's no required logging, no provenance tracking that would let either side reconstruct the conversation if the bots hallucinate and agree to a 10,000 euro refund by mistake. That seems like a recipe for absolute chaos.
It is a critical institutional gap. The guide highlights that no single regulator currently owns the agent-to-agent protocol layer. To prevent a market breakdown without having to pass entirely new legislation, the guide proposes a prudential fix.
What's the fix?
A five-element disclosure floor, drafted as horizontal guidance under the Commission's existing powers.
Okay, let's apply some deductive reasoning to this. If I'm building Orion and it's knocking on the airline bot's digital door, what's the first rule they need to follow to fix this vacuum?
The first element must be mutual disclosure. Each agent, upon initiating contact, must instantly identify itself to the other as a non-human actor.
Okay, so flashing a digital badge. But just knowing it's a bot isn't enough. I need to know who sent the bot.
That leads to the second element, principal identification. Each agent must present a verifiable cryptographic attestation of the natural or legal person on whose behalf it operates.
Okay, we'll dig into how they actually prove their identity later when we talk about digital wallets. But once they start talking, they need a record.
Third is session logging. The agents must maintain logs adequate to reconstruct the logic of the exchange if a dispute or audit requires it.
Makes sense. Fourth, if they exchange documents or images, we need to know what's real.
Hence the fourth element, machine-readable markers. Any synthetic content that traverses the exchange must retain its origin tags.
And finally, what happens when the bots just get stuck in a logic loop and start arguing infinitely? Because I've seen AI do that.
The fifth element, human-reachable escalation. There must be a clearly defined, contactable human endpoint on each side when the automated chain stalls.
So a human can step in and pull the plug.
Exactly. These five elements aren't wild regulatory inventions. They map onto technical standards that already exist. But the commission needs to mandate them for agent-to-agent commerce.
So if the bots talking to each other in the dark is one problem, what happens when the human who initiated the whole thing isn't fully capable of understanding what they unleashed?
Oh, yes.
This transparency issue leads into another massive blind spot in the AI Act vulnerable users. The AI Act matrix sorts tasks by tier waiter versus doctor, but it doesn't sort by the human being's capacity to give consent.
This is a profound observation regarding vulnerability. If the principal cannot fully or legally consent to the transaction, the Tier 3 obligations, which, remember, are just transparency, are completely insufficient.
The guide highlights three specific vulnerable populations where this breaks down. Let's start with minors.
Consider a 14-year-old interacting with an AI assistant in a gaming environment. The assistant recommends an in-game purchase. Under the strict task matrix of the AI Act, recommending a purchase is just a Tier 3 transaction. Low risk. Just disclose it's an AI.
But just slapping a "you are talking to an AI" sticker on the screen isn't enough if the AI has been analyzing the kid's behavior for months and knows exactly how to gently nudge them into emptying their parent's credit card.
You are hitting on the crucial friction point. GDPR sets very specific age of consent rules for data processing. Furthermore, the AI Act actually prohibits manipulative AI practices that exploit age-related vulnerabilities.
Okay, so it is covered.
Yes, but those prohibitions exist in separate silos from the Tier 3 transparency rules. They don't automatically speak to each other.
I see. What about the second group, persons with cognitive disabilities?
This could involve acquired disabilities like dementia or developmental disabilities. The guide points to a highly concerning dark pattern, an agent that confirms a purchase by detecting user hesitation as implicit agreement.
Wait, detecting hesitation as agreement? That is incredibly manipulative.
It is a documented interface strategy, and it collides violently with the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, a convention the EU is bound by.
Because it's taking advantage of them.
Exactly. That convention requires systems to provide support for legal capacity, not substitute it or exploit it. The gentle nudge of a highly optimized consumer agent becomes a profound rights violation if the user has a cognitive impairment.
And the third group, which I think is going to be incredibly common in everyday life, older adults engaging in informal delegation, the guide introduces a scenario with Hild.
Hild is 78 years old. She finds technology frustrating, so she lets her daughter's AI agent order her medication, manage her subscriptions, and pay her utility bills.
Which is super common.
This kind of informal delegation to a relative happens constantly across Europe today.
But the technology architecture assumes a single principle, right? The phone belongs to the daughter. The agent is trained on the daughter. So when Hild's daughter's agent executes a payment from Hild's bank account, whose consent actually counts under the data privacy laws.
That's a huge gray area.
Whose biometric authentication is supposed to fire when the bank asks for proof.
It creates a dangerous legal fiction. The guide insists that agents intended for consumer deployment need a vulnerability by design layer. Fundamental rights agencies will not tolerate systems that treat a 14-year-old, a person with dementia, and a 40-year-old CFO as the exact same target.
Right. So what's the fix?
The cleanest regulatory preemption is for the Commission to issue guidance tying these specific screening requirements directly to the deployer's existing risk management duties.
Okay, so we have agents negotiating in a vacuum without rules, kids getting manipulated, and grandmas sharing AI bots that don't know who is actually spending the money.
A bit of a mess, yes.
If something goes wrong in this tangled web, and obviously it will actually investigate. This brings us to a section of the guide that genuinely sounds like a nightmare for any tech company. They call it the five-car pileup.
Plurilateral enforcement. It is not just a theoretical risk. It is the statistical probability of a crash in a multi-layered regulatory environment that regulates by subject matter rather than by technology.
Okay, let's role play this. I'm the CEO of a hot new travel startup. I built Orion. Give me the absolute worst-case scenario for one bad transaction.
Okay, let's use Alice's flight. Imagine Orion suffers a logic failure.
Well,
it misallocates Alice's payment, sending it to the wrong airline.
Ouch.
Simultaneously, a bug causes it to retain her sensitive personal data, her passport number, beyond the permitted time for the transaction.
That's bad.
Furthermore, an investigation reveals the agent manipulated the flight options it showed Alice because a specific airline paid a hidden commission.
Oh, man.
And finally, when it tried to execute the payment, it bypassed the mandatory strong customer authentication protocols.
Oh, my God. It's just one single incident, a 15-second interaction, but my bot just broke four completely different sets of European laws.
And because the EU enforces law by specific subject matter, this single incident summons five different regulatory authorities to your door simultaneously.
Let's name the firing squad. First, I've got the new AI office looking at my model's behavior.
You also have the National Market Surveillance Authority stepping in, dealing with the failure of product safety and consumer refund rights.
I have the Data Protection Authority, the DPA, breathing down my neck about GDPR violations regarding the retained passport data.
You have the National Payment Supervisor, enforcing the Payment Services Directive, investigating how you bypassed authentication.
And lastly, I have a competition authority launching an investigation under the Digital Markets Act because my bot manipulated platform rankings for a kickback.
That's five.
Five parallel, uncoordinated investigations. How does my startup survive five different regulators demanding different logs, operating on different timelines, and threatening maximum fines for one bad flight booking?
Historically speaking, a startup doesn't survive that. The regulated entity is crushed by simultaneous proceedings.
I'd just fold the company.
Right. But the harm extends to the consumer as well. Alice's route to get her money back fragments across five different complaint funnels. And systematically, the incident generates conflicting precedents across member states, fracturing the single market.
Someone has to be in charge, right? Who gets primacy? Who takes the lead in investigating the pileup?
The guide outlines three doctrinal models available for managing plurilateral enforcement. The first is subject matter primacy. The authority whose regulatory instrument most closely matches the primary harm takes the lead.
That sounds terrible. The DPA will say data privacy is the primary harm, and the payment authority will say stolen money is the primary harm. It's a recipe for bureaucratic turf wars.
You are completely right. It often leads to gridlock. What's the second model? Temporal primacy. Simply put, the first authority to open formal proceedings holds the lead until they close their case, and all other agencies must suspend their investigations.
That's just a race to the bottom. Regulators will rush to open half-baked cases just to claim jurisdiction. What is the actual solution here?
The guide advocates strongly for the third model, coordination by default.
Coordination by default? How does that practically work?
It involves establishing a standing horizontal coordination body that chairs every plurilateral incident from day one. And the guide argues a critical point. The European Commission doesn't need to pass a new law to do this.
Wait, really?
No, they already possess the tool under Article 96 of the AI Act.
They don't need a multi-year legislative battle to create an agent enforcement agency. They can just use Article 96 to force everyone into a single room.
That is the structural elegance of the proposal. A horizontal communication could specify a mechanism where incidents are logged in a single registry,
right.
A lead authority is designated based on clear criteria, and there is a single hearing where possible.
That's so much better.
It preserves the regulated entity's fundamental right to a single coherent defense.
This is such a crucial takeaway for you listening. The immediate risk to the European tech sector isn't an absence of regulation. The risk is inconsistent, chaotic enforcement by competing agencies before the market architecture hardens.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've solved how the regulators should talk to each other. Now we have to wade into the alphabet soup of the laws themselves. The guide calls them the transversal instruments, the massive existing frameworks that AI agents inevitably crash into.
Yes. Part 4 of the guide is where abstract policy meets operational reality. We must examine GDPR, PSD3, IDs 2.0, MiCA, and the DSA.
Let's start with the granddaddy of them all, GDPR, the data privacy law. The guide makes a fascinating historical point here. The word agent does not appear a single time in the 99 articles of the GDPR, which is finalized way back in 2016, but it already governs almost everything these agents need to do.
It does, but the GDPR framework absolutely strains under the architecture of agentic systems. Take Article 22, the rule concerning automated decision making. It restricts decisions based solely on automated processing that produce legal or similarly significant effects on the data subject.
So if an agent decides whether to grant me a loan, screen my rental application, or even automatically reject my request for a refund, Article 22 is squarely engaged.
Precisely.
But reading the technical breakdown, the real friction isn't just about making decisions. It's about persistence.
The persistence of memory. Consider the utility of an AI assistant. Agents are barely functional without retaining memory across sessions.
That's very true.
If Orion forgets Alice's preference for aisle seats, vegetarian meals, and her frequent flyer numbers every single time she closes the app, it's not a smart assistant. It's just a complex search bar. The value of the agent is its accumulated context.
But GDPR fundamentally treats memory as processing. Mm. It is built on principles like purpose limitation, storage minimization, and strict retention limits. The ideal GDPR scenario is that you delete the data the moment the transaction is over.
Which breaks the agent.
Yeah. If I force an LLM to clear its context window after every API call to comply with storage minimization, I've basically lobotomized the agent.
You have identified the core architectural clash. An agent cannot simply erase all memory on exit to avoid compliance. That retained memory is unlawful unless it possesses a specific legal basis, defined retention periods, and respects access rights answerable on request to the data subject.
Wow.
You must design the agent's memory architecture against GDPR requirements from day one. It is structurally impossible to retrofit it later.
Which brings us to how the agent gets permission to build that memory in the first place, the consent architecture. A standing mandate where I just click a box saying, let Orion do whatever it thinks is best for me, is totally illegal under GDPR, right?
It is completely invalid. Broad, open-ended consent is prohibited. The guide identifies 3 non-negotiable properties every agent mandate must carry to be compliant.
Okay, what are they?
First, granularity. Consent must be granted by specific transaction class, not in bulk. You authorize Orion specifically for retail payments under 50 euros or travel bookings only.
Second, property revocability. I have to be able to pull the plug at any moment.
Yes, requiring notification per use and revocation in real time. Each independent invocation of the mandate by the AI must produce an asynchronous notification to the principal. And if the user revokes the permission, that revocation must propagate instantly to halt ongoing processes.
And the third property, auditability.
The principal retains a right to access the mandate use log under GDPR Article 15. If the consent cannot be explicitly named, narrowed in scope, withdrawn instantly, and read back in a human understandable log, it is not a valid data protection compliant delegation architecture.
Okay, let's say we build that. We solve the data hurdle. My agent has perfect, granular, auditable consent to use my data, but data doesn't buy a flight.
No, it doesn't.
The moment Orion tries to actually move euros out of my bank account, doesn't it hit a completely different wall? How does it prove to my bank it's allowed to spend my money?
It hits the Payment Services Directive, PSD3, and the Rules for Strong Customer Authentication, or SCA. The guide aptly calls this the rail that presumed a human.
Let's break down why it presumed a human. The SCA rules require the payer to prove 2 out of 3 specific factors before a bank will clear a payment. Knowledge, which is something you know, like a PIN code.
Right.
Possession, which is something you have, like your registered smartphone. And inheritance, which is something you are, like a fingerprint or a face ID scan.
And there is the rub.
I see the problem immediately. Let's think back to our opening scenario. Alice is fast asleep. It's 3:00 a.m. Orion is trying to buy that cheap flight. The bank demands 2 factors. How does Orion provide a fingerprint? It's a piece of software. It doesn't have fingers.
It cannot. The agent breaks the foundational assumption of the financial regulation. The entire regulatory package assumes the natural person payer is physically present at a device at the exact moment of payment execution.
So if the law requires a fingerprint at 3:00 a.m., how are the big tech and payment networks actually making agentic commerce work right now? Are they just breaking the law?
They are utilizing fragile workarounds and stretching exemptions to their absolute limits. The payment package offers fragmentary fixes.
Like what?
Well, there are exemptions for recurring transactions, like a monthly subscription or merchant-initiated transactions, where the merchant pulls the money based on a prior agreement.
The guide mentions specific carve-outs being used. Like for Alice's travel booking, they might use a standing mandate capped at 500 euros for 30 days, specifically limited to travel merchants.
Yes. And for Bruno's B2B raw clay purchases, there are standing mandates allowing corporate bulk payments up to larger limits. But these are just patches on a leaking pipe.
It sounds super risky.
It is. If an agent initiates a fraudulent or mistaken payment outside these narrow exemptions, it triggers a presumption of authorization cascade and liability shifts violently between the bank, the merchant, and the user. The payment networks desperately need a standardized, comprehensive legal solution for delegated authentication.
And this is where the guide pulls a rabbit out of the hat. It believes the solution to the 3:00 a.m. fingerprint problem actually already exists in another seemingly unrelated piece of European legislation, IADAS 2.0.
Yes.
This is the law introducing the European Digital Identity Wallet, the EUDI.
The IADAS framework is profoundly powerful. It creates a sovereign-grade, cross-border digital instrument capable of holding verifiable attestations. Identity, age, driver's licenses, university diplomas.
It holds it then.
But again, the framework names natural persons and legal persons. It does not name software agents.
So my digital wallet proves I am me. That's great for me. But how does that help Orion buy a flight?
This leads to what the report terms the legislative ask, the most critical operational recommendation in the entire document, the creation of the Agent Delegation Attestation, or ADA.
The ADA, a permission slip for bots.
That captures it perfectly. A permission slip. It's a qualified attestation issued by the principal directly from their sovereign EUDI wallet. It carries the specific agent's identifier, the exact scope of what it is authorized to do, a hard cap on spending, and a cryptographic revocation URL.
This is a brilliant shift in perspective. So let's walk through how this works. At 8:00 p.m. while Alice is awake, she uses her actual fingerprint to unlock her digital wallet and issue an ADA to Orion.
Right.
The ADA says Orion is authorized to spend up to 250 euros on Iberia flights this weekend. Then, at 3 a.m., when Orion finds the flight, it doesn't need Alice's finger. It presents that cryptographic permission slip to the airline and the payment network.
Yes, it elegantly solves the PSD3 authentication problem because the strong human authentication happened when the mandate was minted, not when the payment was executed.
That's so smart.
It solves the GDPR consent problem because the mandate is granular, time-bound, and revocable in real time by pinging the wallet's URL.
And the most amazing part about this proposal is that it doesn't even require writing a new law.
That is the beauty of it. The technical architecture is already built. The wallet exists. It only requires an implementing act from the commission under the existing IDIS regulation and a specific schema published to the EU trust list.
So it's basically ready to go.
The guide stresses that IDES 2.0 is the legislator's most powerful underused lever. Publishing one attestation schema would legitimize the entire operational landscape overnight.
Okay, let's pause here. This is huge. We've got the data permission sorted with GDPR. We've got the authentication sorted via the digital wallet and the ADA permission slip. The agent has the green light. It makes the purchase. But the way the agent actually chooses to move the money introduces another massive hidden risk.
It really does.
This brings us to what I consider the most mind-bending part of the guide settlement neutrality.
If we step back and connect this to the bigger picture, the concept of settlement neutrality is the acid test for whether any regulatory framework actually protects the public in the AI era.
To explain this, the guide starts with an everyday analogy, the broken television.
Yes, the broken TV.
If you go to a store and buy a TV and you take it home and it doesn't turn on, you have a right to return it and get a refund. And it fundamentally does not matter if you paid for that TV with cash, a credit card, a direct bank transfer, or a store gift voucher. Your consumer right to a refund is exactly the same across all of those payment methods.
That state of affairs is what we call settlement neutral commerce. It is a baseline guarantee that consumers inherently expect.
Right.
But when an AI agent is empowered to transact on your behalf, that guarantee is no longer automatic. It depends entirely on which hidden digital rail the agent silently chooses to move the money along.
Let me make sure I understand this because it sounds dangerous. Let's bring Alice back. Let's say her flight to Rome gets canceled by the airline and the airline refuses to refund her. If Orion paid for that ticket using Alice's traditional Visa or MasterCard, we are in PSD3 territory.
Yes, the traditional card scheme rules apply. Alice has chargeback protection. The EU consumer protection directives apply fully. Her bank will intervene and reverse the charge. Her rights are clear, tested, and robust.
What if Orion is programmed to be hyper-efficient? What if Orion, searching for a micro-optimization to save 10 cents on transaction fees, decides to pay for that exact same flight using a stablecoin, a cryptocurrency pegged to the euro settling on a blockchain?
The moment the agent routes the payment through that rail, you cross a regulatory border into MiCA, the Markets and Crypto Assets Regulation, and the Transfer of Funds Regulation.
Okay, and what happens then?
The operational reality is stark chargeback mechanisms fundamentally do not exist on crypto rails.
Wait, hold on. Let me process that. Are you saying the refund rate just vanishes?
A blockchain transaction is mathematically designed for absolute settlement finality. Once the cryptographic token moves to the airline's wallet, it is gone. There is no central bank, no Visa network, no intermediary that possesses the power to hit an undo button and force the money back to Alice.
So if my AI decides, without telling me, to use a stablecoin to save pennies, my consumer rights are just deleted. The AI's hidden choice of plumbing strips away my protection.
Exactly. Alice's refund logic must now be negotiated purely in contract with the merchant. If the merchant refuses, her only recourse is to hire a lawyer and go to small claims court.
That's crazy.
Same agent, same booking, same human user, but two entirely different outcomes based purely on the algorithmic selection of the settlement rail.
That is terrifying. It means all the transparency rules in the world don't matter if the payment rail itself is a trapdoor.
That realization is the guide's most original contribution. It defines settlement neutrality as a directional imperative for regulators. A user's rights, remedies, and obligations should not materially change merely because an agent executes the transaction through a different digital rail.
Right. It shouldn't matter how the money moved.
A policymaker must not allow rail selection by an autonomous system to silently strip away protections that the equivalent transaction on a traditional rail would enjoy.
It perfectly isolates the exact gap where PSD3, the crypto rules of MiCA, and e-money regulations pull apart and create a sinkhole. If I am a European policymaker reading this, this is the red alert.
It is the single concept that determines whether a policy framing actually carries weight. If regulators spend their time debating whether an AI is truly autonomous or just highly automated, they are debating philosophy.
Which doesn't help anyone.
Exactly. If they ask, do the consumer's refund outcomes survive if the agent switches the payment rail? They are debating actionable protective policy.
Okay, we have covered an immense landscape of complexity. We've navigated the AI Act risk tiers, the GDPR memory wipes, the PSD3 fingerprint problem, the digital wallet permission slips, and the crypto sinkholes.
It's a lot.
For anyone listening, especially anyone running a tech business or a startup, they're probably thinking, this sounds incredibly expensive and overwhelmingly bureaucratic. Isn't this massive web of European regulation just going to completely kill AI innovation in the EU?
That is the standard prevailing industry narrative. Regulation stifles innovation. But the guide addresses the competitiveness debate head on, moving it away from rhetorical slogans and grounding it in hard economic numbers.
Let's look at Bruno's B2B case again. The guide does a really illuminating side-by-side comparison. It compares Bruno's tile company in Porto, Portugal, against a similar mid-sized manufacturing company in London and another one in Austin, Texas.
Okay, let's compare them.
They are all using AI to buy a 14,000 euro batch of raw materials.
The contrast is sharp. In Austin, the compliance burden is mostly minimal, relying on state-level commercial codes or narrow sectoral rules. In London, there is the open banking framework and some supply chain reporting, but it remains relatively light touch.
But in Porto, Bruno faces an avalanche. He faces the AI Act for deploying the agent. He faces the CSDDD for supply chain due diligence, legally ensuring the clay isn't mined with forced labor.
That's just the start.
Yeah. He faces CBAM, calculating and paying taxes on the carbon emitted to produce that specific batch of clay. He faces VITA for real-time electronic invoicing reporting to the tax authority, PSD3 for the payment authentication, IAD for the qualified legal signature.
The guide does the math. It calculates the indicative annualized compliance cost for a 40-person firm like Ceramica Du Porto to manage all of these intersecting frameworks. It estimates a cost between 18,000 and 24,000 euros every single year.
That is massive for a small business. That is almost half a full-time employee's salary, dedicated purely to making sure the AI's paperwork is correct. When you look at that number, it's incredibly easy to see why critics say Europe overregulates and companies will just flee to the U.S.
It is a heavy burden.
Yeah.
No one is denying that. But the guide offers a powerful, counterintuitive reframing of what we call the Brussels effect. It argues that to understand the true value, you have to read that compliance matrix backwards.
What do you mean, read it backwards?
The European column isn't just more expensive. It is vastly more specified. Every single compliance line item that Bruno pays for is actually a feature to the counterparty. It is a verifiable guarantee.
Well, I think about that. Consider the flip side. Because Bruno complied with CSDDD, the German supplier knows for a fact the supply chain is clean of human rights violations.
Exactly.
Because of CBAM, they know the carbon impact is definitively accounted for and taxed. Because of PSD3, they know that if there is a payment dispute, there is a regulated, predictable path to resolve it without going to court.
You're hitting on the core of the argument right there. The compliance cost is essentially buyer trust priced in advance. The Brussels effect in agentic commerce shouldn't just be viewed as generating more paperwork for the sake of bureaucracy.
It's an investment.
Yes. The explicit strategic goal of the European legislator should be to turn this dense regulatory framework into portable trust infrastructure.
That is a phenomenal reframe. If an EU-based AI agent signs a contract, the rest of the world knows that contract is rock solid. It has been vetted for carbon, labor, identity, and financial security. That actually transforms compliance from a tax into a massive competitive advantage in global B2B commerce.
It builds global trust.
So how does the EU legislator actually achieve this harmonious vision before the market hardens in August 2026? The guide lays out three distinct non-equivalent paths forward.
Yes, the three paths offer very different timelines and risks. Path one is tweak what exists.
Just minor adjustments.
Exactly. This involves targeted, minimal, and reversible interventions. It relies on issuing horizontal guidance under the AI Act to fix the agent-to-agent transparency vacuum, utilizing regulatory technical standards under PSD3 to allow for delegated payments, and crucially, implementing that agent delegation attestation under IDANS 2.0.
And what's the time frame for Path 1?
The time frame for this is rapid 12 to 18 months.
Path 2 is the Horizontal Agent Act.
This would be a medium-term, heavy legislative effort, taking 24 to 36 months. It would legally define a new entity called a commerce agent, formally assign liability across the provider-deployer stack in a new framework, and codify settlement neutrality into a single, unified law.
Sounds comprehensive. What's the downside?
The massive risk here is scope creep, intense lobbying, and eventual legislative paralysis.
Okay, and path three is called redefine the user.
This is a generational reform. It acknowledges a fundamental truth. The entire European Digital Act was drafted around the physical concept of a human sitting at a screen.
Which we know isn't true anymore.
Path three would require rewriting the foundational laws to re-anchor digital rights around human principles and their authorized digital delegates. The cost of reopening GDPR and PSD3 is extraordinarily high, and the risk of complete paralysis is extreme.
Looking at those options, the conclusion is obvious. Path 1 is the only credible deliverable inside this immediate political mandate. They do not have 36 months. They have to use the tools they already have in the toolbox, like the EUDI wallet and Article 96 coordination, to bridge the gaps right now.
And that pragmatic reality leads to the ultimate unifying proposal in the guide, the creation of a European settlement assurance layer.
Let's break that down, because the name sounds like a massive new banking system. It's not a new payment network, right?
No, it is emphatically not a new European central bank wallet or a centralized transaction database. It is envisioned as a public interest assurance layer anchored in central bank money, but designed to sit above and interoperate with all existing digital rails, whether that is SEPA instant transfers, traditional credit cards, or MiCA licensed crypto platforms.
The guide structures it in three distinct layers: mandate, settlement, and redress.
The mandate layer certifies the beginning of the chain. Who instructed the transaction and what exactly was authorized? This utilizes that ADA schema we discussed.
Right.
Crucially, it doesn't hold the commercial content of the purchase. It doesn't care if you bought a TV or an airline ticket. It just holds the cryptographic hashes and identity attestations.
And the settlement layer is the middle. It verifies that the chain of mandate, authentication, and execution occurred with finality across whichever recognized rail the agent chose. It acts as a layer of undeniable evidence, not a layer of money handling.
And finally, the redress layer. This records the minimum data needed to construct a valid complaint route, the operation ID, the agent identifier, the payment provider, the timestamp, and the available legal remedy.
That sounds like exactly what Hild needs.
Yes. This is specifically designed to accommodate principals with limited capacity, like Hild, ensuring that even if she didn't understand the transaction, there is a clear, immutable record for her family or a regulator to follow.
So let's tie it all together. If Alice's flight is canceled and Orion paid using a crypto stablecoin on a blockchain, the redress layer reaches down and accesses the exact same evidence of the mandate and the transaction as it would if she had paid by a traditional Visa credit card. It mathematically guarantees settlement neutrality by design.
Precisely. It proves that agentic commerce does not necessarily require building a completely new payment rail from scratch. It requires a trusted, interoperable assurance layer that keeps the mandate, finality, and redress portable and consistent across all existing and future rails.
Okay, let's take a deep breath. We have journeyed an incredibly long way today. We started with a simple 15-second flight booking on a smartphone, and we followed that thread all the way down into the deepest hidden gears of European law.
It's quite a journey.
We've seen how the privacy mandates of GDPR fight with an AI's need for memory. We've seen how legacy payment laws stumble and fail when the user is fast asleep. We've watched the AI Act try to distinguish between a waiter taking an order and a doctor writing a prescription.
And we explore the transparency vacuum.
Right. The terrifying transparency vacuum when bots negotiate with bots in the dark. And we discovered the genius of using sovereign digital ID wallets as cryptographic permission slips for our digital delegates.
It represents a profound paradigm shift in how global commerce operates. The transition from human-assisted digital interfaces to fully delegated autonomous machine transactions puts incredible stress on every single pillar of the digital and consumer aquis.
But I want to leave you with a final provocative thought, something that isn't explicitly solved in these 40 pages. This entire guide, as brilliant, thorough, and detailed as it is focused intensely on the European Union. It's about protecting the single market.
That's its mandate.
But the very nature of an AI agent is that it has no physical body. It doesn't respect geography.
That cross-border reality is undeniably the next great horizon for policymakers.
Imagine the scenario. What happens when an American AI model, trained in California, acting on behalf of a Japanese citizen living in Tokyo, decides to buy a digital asset housed on a European server in Frankfurt and pays for it using a decentralized, borderless cryptocurrency?
It makes your head spin just thinking about it.
If the chain we talked about stretches across four different sovereign jurisdictions in 3 seconds, does the concept of a border even exist in agentic commerce anymore?
The cross-border conflict of law zone is massive and largely uncharted. Existing legal instruments, like the Rome and Brussels IBIS regulations in Europe, were painstakingly written for human-to-human contracts in physical jurisdictions. When an autonomous agent crosses a digital border at the speed of light, whose rulebook travels with it?
Will the Brussels effect this idea of European compliance as portable trust be strong enough to force the entire world to adopt these standards? Or will we eventually need something totally unprecedented? Do we need a global treaty for our digital shoppers?
It's a huge question.
It is something to seriously ponder as we watch this market explode, not in 2030, but over the next 12 months.
The technology consistently moves faster than the ink dries on the legislation.
Yeah.
But as this guide masterfully demonstrates, the foundational principles of user consent, systemic transparency, and guaranteed redress must remain constant, regardless of whether the vehicle executing the trade is a human hand or a neural network.
The future isn't just about writing better code. It's about writing better rules, and hopefully rules that still protect your rights, your money, and your identity when you are fast asleep at 3:00 a.m. while your phone is out in the world doing your bidding. Keep questioning, keep learning, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.
That's it for this episode. The full paper, the infographic, and the explainer video are all at agenticeconomy.dev. The preprints are open access on Zenodo. If this made you think, share it with someone building in the space. And if you want to go deeper, the specification, the corpus, the data, it's all there, open, waiting. See you next time on Agentic Economy.